Iran says it wants a sustainable agreement with other JCPOA parties in Vienna talks aimed at ensuring a responsible return of the U.S. to the deal. High-level security talks between Russia and the U.S. get underway in Geneva amid pessimism about the outcome of the negotiations. And the Kazakh president says that recent violent protests in his country have been an attempt at coup and that order has been restored. I'm your host, Behruz Najaf. It's a great pleasure to have you with us. As the Vienna talks to revive the 2015 deal continue, Iran says it wants to make sure that the U.S. does not treat the JCPOA with contempt again.
Iran and the U.S. have exchanged views through unofficial written texts on four issues. Those are ensuring the effective removal of sanctions, nuclear commitments, the issue of verification, and obtaining guarantees that no other U.S. administration in Washington would make a mockery of international relations and this agreement.
Khatibzadeh says that the Vienna talks only focus on the full, responsible, and verifiable U.S. return to the deal after its unilateral withdrawal in 2018. The Iran official said that Tehran is seeking a lasting and reliable agreement and that the talks have made good progress. However, he stressed that Iran alone cannot maintain the pace of the negotiations and wants the other side to speed up its efforts. Khatibzadeh noted that Iran has detected a change in the approach on the other side. He said while the opposite side previously sought to extract concessions through a media misinformation campaign, it's now realized that this approach is futile. Now, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps is warning that the country is yet to take full revenge for the U.S. assassination of top general Qasem Soleimani in 2020. IRGC Commander Major General Hossein Salami says Iran's missile strikes on Ain al-Assad military base in Iraq was only part of the response. The general says that Washington should know it cannot launch an act of aggression against the nation and avoid its retaliation. He says that Iran is not daunted by enemies and will defend its independence. The comments were made days after the second anniversary of Soleimani's assassination in a U.S. drone strike. Iran responded by hitting the U.S. airbase of Ain al-Assad with over a dozen missiles. The Iranian foreign minister has criticized the U.S. and its allies for what it calls the wrong policies in Afghanistan over the past 20 years. Hossein Amir Abdullahian was speaking with the Afghan acting foreign minister, Amir Khan Muttaqi, here in Tehran. He said that history has shown that no foreign power can occupy and rule Afghanistan. The top diplomat warned that the U.S. is seeking to create a rift between Afghanistan and its neighboring countries. He also called for the release of the Afghan central bank assets that remain frozen by the U.S. The Afghan official said that Iran has always stood by his country. Amir Khan Muttaqi said that the U.S. left his country with a disgraceful defeat and still continues its policies against the people there. Now, we've talked to activist and commentator Firas al-Najm about U.S. policies in Afghanistan, and he believes that Washington supports crises and poverty in the country, as it does for other nations in West Asia.
I mean, it's very clear that the U.S. used Afghanistan as a landscape to practice all their weapons and train there and, you know, destroy the nation and keep it in the worst conditions. This was the motive from the American side, is that they, you know, fabricated a justification to invade that country, and this was an area for them to just try all their new weapons and, you know, train their army to get stronger. And it was the door to open in the Middle East to expand their invasions and to try to install fear in other countries. The U.S. obviously is not going to release these funds because, like you said, that they want the poverty, they want the problems, they want people to be suffering and hungry, so there can be more disunity and there can be more instability in Afghanistan. And then they will hope that this will somehow create chaos and spill over to Iran. Unfortunately, they don't care about human rights. They don't care about humanity. If they really did, they wouldn't be causing all these crises in Afghanistan, in Yemen, supporting the Saudi coalition, supporting the Israeli occupation of Palestine, blockading right now and causing a big embargo on Lebanon. You know, they've occupied Iraq for such a long time, and they left Iraq in the worst conditions. They won't even let the Iraqi government purchase fighter jets to safeguard their country.
Now, Russia warning the U.S. and NATO against their approach toward the ongoing security negotiations in Geneva. Moscow said that the West could face a worse security situation if they do not show interest in dialogue on security guarantees that Moscow demands. It says the talks should look at a question of Ukraine not joining NATO. Moscow has already ruled out any concession following the first round of talks with the U.S. The two sides have kicked off a new round of negotiations. And this is why Washington has said that no breakthrough is expected and that progress depends on de-escalation from Moscow. Russians are also scheduled to hold high-level discussions with NATO and Europeans. The talks are aimed at wide-ranging new security arrangements between Russia and the West. The Kremlin demands guarantees that NATO won't expand further eastward. Now, we've spoken to political commentator Markis Papadopoulos about the talks between Russia and the U.S., and he says that he welcomes the negotiations, but believes that Washington's promises would mean nothing in the long run.
The forthcoming meeting between the Americans and the Russians concerning the Ukraine crisis. And I also welcome the reports we have been receiving in the last few days that the Americans may offer the Russians the possibility of Washington scaling down NATO's presence in Eastern Europe, which indicates that Russia has, as many of us have said for many years now, a legitimate grievance over NATO's presence in Eastern Europe, which is a gross violation of the NATO-Russia founding treaty of 1997. An American pledge in writing would be welcomed, but in the long term, it would not mean anything. After all, America has violated the NATO-Russia founding treaty of 1997 by positioning NATO forces in Eastern Europe. Secondly, when NATO bombed the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia in 1999, the Americans, who are the de facto leader of NATO, violated Article 1 of NATO's founding treaty, which clearly stipulates that NATO will never use force to resolve a dispute. Mm-hmm. So an American pledge in writing is not worth the paper it's written on.
The president of Kazakhstan says the violent protests of the recent days in his country have been an attempted coup. Qasem Jomart Tokayev says that the unrest was coordinated by an unknown center that targeted the city of Almaty and nine other regions. He says that order has been restored in Kazakhstan now, but the hunt for terrorists will continue. Officials said earlier that 164 people have been killed and some 8,000 have been arrested. That in addition to security officers who were either killed or injured. The rallies sparked last week by increasing fuel prices marked the deadliest unrest in Kazakhstan's post-Soviet history. They resulted in the resignation of the prime minister and his cabinet. President Tokayev says that he will submit a new government line on Tuesday.
Kazakhstan faces its worst violence experienced since the independence of the Central Asian country in the early 1990s as the Soviet Union collapsed. Dozens of people have died while public buildings across the country have been looted and torched over the past week. It all began with fuel reforms that took effect on January 1, 2022, leading to the doubling of liquefied petroleum gas prices.
Simple events, increasing prices for liquid gas, which most people in Kazakhstan using as a fuel for cars and as a fuel for heating the houses, that was a trigger that kind of event.
Following that, demonstrations began in the western Manjistau province on Sunday, but then spread across the country and turned violent, resulting in clashes between protesters and security forces. Kazakh President Kasym-Jomart Tokayev's response included accepting the resignation of the government and announcing fixed fuel prices, but also ordering a crackdown. The unrest prompted Tokayev to appeal for help from the Collective Security Treaty Organization to restore peace and security. The Collective Security Treaty Organization is a Russian-led alliance of former Soviet states including Russia, Belarus, Tajikistan, Armenia, Kyrgyzstan, and Kazakhstan. Tokayev blames foreign-trained terrorists for the unrest. He describes a large proportion of the protesters as criminals, saying 20,000 bandits were involved in the unrest in Almaty, Kazakhstan's largest city and the center of the recent unrest. Consequently, he has authorized security forces to open fire without warning in case of further unrest. Initial peaceful protests appear to have been subverted by seemingly well-organized groups of rioters, particularly on Wednesday when the police seemed to leave key installations in the city unprotected. The unrest is seen as an attempt by foreign parties to provoke color revolutions in the ex-Soviet country, modeled on the Rose Revolution in Georgia and the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, which Russia has blamed on the West as an attempt to undermine the security of Kazakhstan.
Obviously, some game of the superpower and Western interference and covert operations always exist.
Russia's top envoy in the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, blames Washington's foreign policy for helping to provoke the crisis in Kazakhstan. Antonov says the root cause of the mayhem is the destabilization in the Middle East and Afghanistan, caused in turn by 2 decades of U.S. military intervention across Western and Central Asia under the pretext of defending human rights and democracy.
Now, the unrest in Kazakhstan has left tens of people dead. Public buildings were torched and ransacked in several cities, including the main city of Almaty. The government called for assistance from a regional security alliance led by Russia to quell the unrest. Meantime, Moscow has criticized Washington's efforts, said that Kazakhstan would be settled with a Russian presence.
Russia says the reason behind its decision to provide military support for Kazakhstan is reaffirming its commitment to allied obligations within the Collective Security Treaty Organization. In addition, Moscow views the recent developments in Kazakhstan as externally provoked attempts at disrupting the security and integrity of the state through violent means, including trained and organized armed groups. Russia also slammed U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken as boorish for saying Kazakhstan would be settled with Russian presence after asking Moscow to send in troops. This came after Blinken told reporters on Friday
that I think one lesson of recent history is that once Russians are in your house, it's sometimes very difficult to get them to leave.
Moscow ramped up the criticism further, also going on to cite a number of Washington's invasions, interventions, and military occupations over the decades, suggesting Blinken might learn a history lesson of his own. It mentioned unfortunate people who had the bad luck to see these uninvited guests at their doorstep, naming Native Americans, Koreans, Vietnamese, and Syrians, among others.
But Russia has much better track record than the United States, because the United States has about 800 military objects and bases around the globe, and staying unwelcome in a lot of countries.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Kazakh counterpart, Kasym-Jomart Tokayev, held a phone conversation to discuss the ongoing unrest in Kazakhstan on Saturday. The two discussed steps to restore order in the country. Tokayev also informed Putin in detail about the situation in the country, noting that it is developing towards a stabilization.
Harsh winter has worsened the already dire condition of millions of Afghans struggling with hunger and poverty, especially those who have become homeless or displaced due to droughts or conflicts over the past months. We have a report from Kabul.
Snowfall and dropping temperatures have increased the problems of the poor and needy people across Afghanistan. Here, we are visiting some displaced families who face harsh conditions in their camps in Kabul. Bushra Amiria, mother of 10, is displaced from Helmand province. She says she has nothing to feed her children or heat her simple shack.
I am a widow and have several children. I'm really desperate to feed them and keep them warm. My neighbors used to help us, but now everyone is short of money and food.
Other people in this camp have the same problems. Almost all of them are deprived of their basic needs.
There is no hope for survival. We are left here with no house, no money, and no bread. We are human beings. Why is no one paying attention to us or help us? What should we do in this cold weather and severe snowfall?
These displaced families hope that the charities and the government could help them to survive the winter. Hundreds of men and women from two camps have come here to enlist them for receiving some aids.
Here you see internally displaced people from different provinces of Afghanistan. They are in urgent need of food and medicines. In addition, their tents are being collapsed due to rainfalls. We are enlisting for humanitarian aid, but it won't be sufficient for survival.
Bishra Amiri is happy as she receives some aid and food donated by the WFP and the Gulzad Group.
I'm very happy today because I have received some food for my family. My children will have something to eat for next month. We thank charities for their humanitarian aid. However, we need more assistance, including warming clothes and heating.
Afghanistan's financial system has been in a free fall since the Taliban took over, partly due to aid cuts and the freeze of some $10 billion in Afghan assets by the U.S.
In addition to dealing with cold weather, most of these families are unable to buy food and medicines. They say it will be very difficult for them to survive this harsh winter if urgent assistance is not provided. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The court in Myanmar has reportedly convicted ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi to 4 years in prison on criminal charges. The court found Suu Kyi guilty of incitement for illegally possessing walkie-talkies and also guilty of breaking COVID rules. The sources say that she'll remain under house arrest while other cases against her proceed. Suu Kyi has faced trial on dozens of charges since her ouster in a coup last February. The charges, which she denies, carry combined maximum sentences of more than 100 years behind bars. Myanmar has witnessed nationwide rallies since the coup. The junta has led a deadly crackdown to end the protests. Now, in Bangladesh, a fire sweeps through a Rohingya refugee camp in the country's southeast, destroying hundreds of homes. Officials say that the blaze hit a complex in Cox's Bazar, where more than a million Rohingya refugees live. No mid reports on casualties. The fire is under control now. The cause is still unknown. A devastating fire there last March killed 15 people. Cox's Bazar has become the world's biggest refugee camp after Rohingya took refuge there following a deadly military crackdown in Myanmar in 2017. The United Nations described the situation there as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. Economic Divide.
He is one of the youngest presidents of a country. Gabriel Boric has been elected into office in Chile, promising an orderly economy. But what is that? Is he going to pull Chile's economy out of the one that has led it to be one of the most unequal countries in the world? Hi, I'm Kavit Halfway. Welcome to another edition of Economic Divide, where we will look at Chile's economic future under its new president. Coming up, Chile's new president, his economic plans, promise to install a welfare state, to expand social rights, but to do so with fiscal responsibility. Will that help pull Chile out of its economic downturn? Also, we will take a look at Chile's inequality, one of the world's most unequal nations. But why, when it has an abundance of natural resources like copper, not to mention lithium? Also, we're going to take a look at a trend that is happening in Latin America. Boric is one of a handful of Latin American leaders who has come from the left. Why is Latin America seeing a rise of the left? Also, something that has been noticed in Peru. And the big one is possibly to come in Brazil.
It was an election that just months ago did not foresee the rise of a 35-year-old to the highest job in the country. But that is what happened. Gabriel Boric, a former student leader, won the presidential election in Chile with 55% of the vote. He describes himself as a moderate socialist who will seek to maintain fiscal discipline as he advances his reforms. Some of these reforms include raising taxes on the rich, raising taxes on the mining industry, rejecting projects that damage the environment, improving social services, dismantling the private pension system, which is why you have economists looking at Chile's economic future with pessimism.
When Chile's new president-elect won the elections, it looked like Wall Street was attacking him because of his liberal policies, economically speaking, with many headlines sounding off the alarm on his win. Like this one, President-elect Boric aims to undo Chile's economic progress. The Wall Street Journal said his wish list included ending private pensions. It would destroy Chile's capital markets. Now, this headline was a no-holds-barred display of using scare tactics. Aside from saying how Chile's stock market and currency have fallen, it went on to say that the new president would oppose some mining projects and would govern a divided Congress. There's about 5 negative points in this particular descriptions. And if that wasn't enough, the article goes on to describe Boric as the leader of a left-wing coalition, which included the Chilean Communist Party, further describing Boric as bearded and tattooed 35-year-old former student leader. But Boric's critics were in for a surprise. As of December 31st, Bloomberg reported that Chile's unemployment rate had fallen for the 8th straight month, reaching levels last seen before the pandemic. The jobless rate fell to 7.5% between September and November, and retail sales in November grew 16.7% lower than expected. Well, joining us for this segment is Carlos Patricio Gonzalez. Now, he's got a rather long resume here, which is noteworthy for us to highlight. He's a senior lecturer at London South Bank University in the UK. He's also a Chilean former political prisoner of Pinochet regime, exiled in Britain as a result. Expertise he has in urbanism, architecture, and technology design at City Resilience. And currently, he's doing research into homelessness in Chile with a sabbatical during 2022 to research the plight of people in homeless dwellers, emergency camps in Santiago and in Valparaiso. All right, well, welcome, a warm welcome to you, Carlos, and thanks for joining us here on Economic Divide. We're looking at Chile's new president-elect in terms of his, what he has called fiscal discipline. He wants to enact reforms that he has said, like raising taxes on the rich, and also on the mining industry, rejecting projects that are not too climate-friendly when it comes to that. And also, we're looking at how he wants to dismantle the pension system. Are these promised reforms actually realistic? Do you think he'll be able to do them?
It will depend. It will depend on several factors. There are talks now by the forces that support Gabriel Boric with other center-left forces like the Socialists, the Christian Democrats, etc., who they were in government in the recent years, especially the government of Michel Bachelet led in the past, in order to broaden the support for the changes. Not especially when we are encountering a parliament recently elected that is almost even, advantages for the left on the lower chamber, but equally divided in the higher chamber. So there are even talks to right-wing moderate forces in the parliament in order to pass legislation, because many of the policies that Boric bring in to the front need be passed through parliament, especially tax reforms, the end of the pension system, new health services system, etc.
All right, very good. Let's see what Dennis Small thinks. Let me bring him in. Dennis Small is a Latin America editor at the Executive Intelligence Review. Dennis Small, welcome to Economic Divide. We're looking at the Chilean new president-elect and some of the promises that he has made, such as eliminating the pension system or rejecting projects, especially in the industrial sector, that are not climate-friendly, not to mention raising taxes on the rich. Do you think that he's going to actually be able to execute these promised reforms? Especially, obviously, ones that he ran during his presidential campaign.
Well, I think he will certainly attempt to lessen the divide, but again, Chile is a little bit of a microcosm of the whole world. Over the last 2 years of the pandemic and the 10 years since the last crisis, the inequality worldwide has grown phenomenally, where the vulgarly rich have become extremely vulgarly rich, and there is broader impoverishment, hunger, and disease around the world, with some countries facing potential starvation of the majority of their population, such as Afghanistan. That said, I think that Chile does have potential to move in the direction of lessening that divide. Chile is a young country on top of everything else. It's not only is the president young at 35, but the population that voted for him is generally quite young, and the party system, the existing institutional parties, have been very badly defeated in this election, which means that people are looking for a new and different way out. I think a lot of Boric's success or not will depend on him providing a mission, a sense of national purpose, especially to the young in the country. And in this regard, one of the most promising areas, in my view, especially to the degree which the Belt and Road extends itself through South America, and Chile becomes part of that with Argentina and Brazil after the elections and others.
Hello and welcome to our first InfoNews section of the year. And we are going to start off this section with a piece of news that shows the U.S. double standards in full display. Now, this piece of crypto news was an eye-opener. It said that the U.S. government has a huge secret crypto stockpile that it had been seizing and then auctioning off cryptocurrencies, and this was in a span of years. It had gained so much steam that it enlisted the help of the private sector to manage the storage and the sales of its hoard of tokens. So much for the U.S. being against crypto and Bitcoin in particular. Moving on to our next piece, it's the holiday season for Americans, but many are not in a festive mood, as evident from this headline. 21 million Americans don't have enough to eat this holiday season. This is especially true for the ones who are in the low-income category. Low-income families may soon face additional pressures as monthly child tax credit payments are ending. Not good news for, obviously, low-income Americans in the U.S. And staying with the U.S. for our next piece, this headline posed the question, what's driving higher prices? The answer, unchecked corporate power. But the real reason for inflation is the increasing concentration of the American economy into the hands of a few. And who are the few? They are the corporate giants with the power to raise prices. After all, they need to make up for the losses that were incurred during the pandemic. And our final piece, in the growing competition between the U.S. and China, China has unveiled new plans to spearhead robot revolution. Automation plans have come amid escalating tech rivalry with the United States. Now, its goal to digitize the operations of 70% of its domestic manufacturers by the year 2025.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
In this in-depth section, we will look at the rise of the left in Latin America, especially now that Chile's new president-elect, Gabriel Boric, has swept into power. But is there really a surge in leftist parties? Well, for starters, what is the meaning of left-wing in politics? Taking a look at the definition, the left refers to people and groups that actually have what's called liberal or revolutionary views. This can include communism or it can even include socialism. Meanwhile, the word right, in contrast, it refers to people or groups that have conservative views. It also can include extreme nationalistic viewpoints. Okay? All right, now, in our case, our focus is the left. Is there a rise of the left in Latin America? That answer is a resounding yes. It began with the win of Manuel López Obrador, the Mexican president, back in 2018. Xiomara Castro, the Honduran president, which became the first female president, is another example. Moving on to Pedro Castillo, Peru's president, who saw a narrow win in the presidency there. And of course, Gabriel Boric, the Chilean president-elect, which has come into power, our subject of this program. And now there are speculations on this man, Luis Inácio Lula da Silva, to become Brazil's next president. That's a big win, obviously, for him if that happens. Now, comparisons are already being made to the icons who are described as anti-imperialist and anti-capitalist. They need no description, really. I'm sure these figures are familiar to you. The late Fidel Castro, the late Hugo Chavez, Fidel Castro of Cuba, Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, and of course, you have at the end there, the Bolivian former president, Evo Morales. Now, why are people in Latin America actually voting for candidates to the left instead of a conservative government or ones to the right? Well, in short, raging poverty is one of the reasons, which is fanned by the COVID-19 pandemic now, which has actually pushed people to the left or to choose candidates that are from the left. People want a leader that not only promises economic prosperity, but this is important. They want an economic overhaul. I mean, they want the system changed. They are favoring economic overhaul over the bigger government and higher social spending, which has not given them economic prosperity. At the same time, people are rising up to reclaim their democracies and also to reclaim their constitution. Well, in the case of Chile, one is actually being written. Okay, rejoining us in this section is Dennis Small, Latin American editor at Executive Intelligence Review. Dennis, welcome back. We're looking at left-wing forces that are gaining ground in Latin America, the focus of this section over here. You're having elections being won by what's called the leftist candidates who are now presidents from Honduras to Peru, for example. Now, Brazil is supposed to be the next big one. Why has this occurred? Is that a sign of defeat for the Western economic model, do you think?
Yes, it is definitely a sign of defeat for the Western economic model. The question remains is, will there be a viable positive alternative in place to replace it? The simple defeat of an existing system and its institutions does not necessarily mean that the future will be bright. We could also descend into an era of extreme chaos, wars, and collapse of different forms. But there's no question but that the existing institutions, the parties, and other political forms across Ibero-America have been vastly discredited under the conditions of the crisis. And that has everything to do with the fact that the system in the transatlantic sector is in fact coming down. The neoliberal economic model has failed tremendously, and it's just getting worse under the conditions of the pandemic that's now underway.
Let's bring in Carlos Gonzalez, who joins us, the senior lecturer at London SoftBank University, to see what he thinks. Carlos Gonzalez, we just heard our guest there, Dennis Small. We're talking about the left-wing forces that are regaining control in Latin America. Do you agree that that's indeed happening? Is that a sign of defeat for the Western economic model, do you think?
I don't think neither at the moment. Neither of the two suggestions, the end or sign of defeat or triumph of Western economic model. We have to remember that the economy model that we got in Chile is called neoliberalism, which comes directly from Milton Friedman, Capitalism and Freedom, put together in Chile by the Chicago Boys, which took the economic part of the government of the dictatorship, Pinochet dictatorship, and they imposed the trinity of free market. Trinity, what we call privatization, deregulation, and cutting social spending.
He faces many challenges ahead. The split Congress, meaning no majority there, the sharp economic slowdown, although it could be short-term, and the writing of a new constitution. A split Congress is going to be a tricky one to handle. He will need to negotiate and make deals and alliances. And this could weaken his appeal among backers with high expectations of rapid change. For one of the most unequal countries in the world, Boric made some promises which were part of his appeal towards a win. He said we cannot continue to allow the poor to pay for the inequalities of Chile, adding we will reach out and build bridges so our citizens can live a better life.
When it comes to Chile, one thing stands out about this country in particular, and that is the abundant mineral wealth. Take copper, for example. Did you know that Chile is the number one producer of copper in the entire world? The country has been the world's top copper producer now for over three decades, and today, close to 50% of the country's exports come from copper-related products. Now, comes the next natural resource that Chile has, which is in great demand worldwide. Can you guess? Well, it's lithium. You know, the stuff used in batteries for portable devices. Chile comes in second after Australia and before China when it comes to lithium production. But when it comes to the reserves, it's another story. Chile has the largest amount of lithium reserves in the world, outweighing Australia by a lot, as seen here. With these top two natural reserves in a possession of Chile, you might say it should be a rich country. Yet, Chile is one of the most unequal countries in the world. By unequal, we are referring to income inequality. Looking at this snapshot, which covers years 2014 to 2020, inequality is at around 52%. Simply put, richest earned around 52% more than the rest. So, will Chile's new president, Gabriel Boric, spread the wealth with all these natural resources that are moneymakers? That should happen, but there is a catch. You see, Boric ran on a platform of clean energy. The incoming president has been passed the rewriting of the constitution. The country is currently writing a new constitution to tackle a climate and ecological emergency. The new constitution places the future of the country's climate readiness in the hands of its 155 architects. Well, that does it for this section. I do appreciate any comments or questions that you may have. Our links and addresses are in front of you now. From me, Matti, it's goodbye until next week.
The win by Gabriel Boric is an important one for Chile, given the vast natural resources that this country has. Well, he's got the opportunity to make life for many Chileans across the spectrum, especially for the poor and even the middle class, better, albeit through a model that is climate friendly. But the bigger picture here is the rise of the left in Latin America, or better yet, the defeat of the Western economic model. Now, maybe the model might have been sound economically, but the people at the helm, steered by the West, like the U.S., failed where it mattered the most, and that is the people. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you on board. From Ikove Takwe and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents. for humanity. Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio. And you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi as-salam, and especially the justice of Ali alayhi as-salam. It is very important when we look at the justice of Ali alayhi as-salam is to look at the time of Ali alayhi as-salam. During the last days of the Khilafah of Uthman, and those who were in power were who were appointed by him, and especially the members of the Umayyad family, who were the kinsmen and relatives of the Khalifa himself, had made it a practice that they openly opposed the Islamic rule and regulations. They humiliated people, treated them like slaves, and made them so much afraid of the rule that they could not pick up the courage to stand before him and mention their grievance. They played with their lives in the same manner in which they played with their property. They did not refrain from shedding the blood of the people for their personal benefits, and no one could dare take revenge. That was just a historical fact. They were not afraid of taking bribes or looting the property of other people. Their continuous activities and conditions and circumstances showed that their intentions were very clear, that they were going to be oppressors, and they would, you know, have the blood and the lives of the people in their hand. And such an action and acts that were committed by the Umayyad family, especially at the last, were the months or weeks of the rule of Uthman, the Muslims were outraged. They were in uproar. And if you read the books of history, you see that the house of Uthman itself was surrounded by the Muslims. They would try to come to the house and kill him, and which they did eventually, because they could not stand the corruption. It was clear that they were going to, the Umayyad dynasty, they were going to get to a stage where there is nothing left to be called human rights, nothing left to be called the human dignity, nothing left to be called justice. And in the midst of all this, you have Ali alayhi salam, seeing all this happen in front of his eyes, being unfolded. Now, Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, he had to enforce equality and justice at the same time. So when Uthman himself was, his house was surrounded by people, and people trying to kill him, they prevented him from even having water to drink. Now, Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi, in one hand he has established justice. In another hand he has established equality. Well, that man needs to, live. And you can see how sensitive and delicate the situation is. If it was anyone beside Amir al-Mu'minin being in that position, things would have went horribly wrong in the Muslim history. Let's take a short break, then we will continue, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam. On one hand, we had the Umayyad dynasty, or the Umayyad, at least the family, the relatives of the Uthman, trying to loot and, you know, create havoc in the Muslim world. And on the other hand, Ali alayhi salam was determined to enforce equality and justice with all his might. And on the other hand, these persons were keen to have the reins of government in their own hand and to possess such much wealth and property as possible. Well, that was their aim, right? This is what Muawiyah did. Between these two conditions, they acted like gamblers, hoping to seize an opportunity to bring about a revolution and consequently to appropriate all benefits to themselves, entertaining the worst passion and desires in their minds. That this is exactly there was their aim. This is what they wanted. There is no doubt about the fact that the responsibility assumed by Imam Ali alayhi salam at that time were extremely difficult and enormous. Various reasons and circumstances had made Imam Ali alayhi salam face many difficulties which could not be overcome easily. The world of the time, or the world of that time, was topsy turvy. The conditions were, revolutionary was about to take place, and the events were frightening, and the possibilities of Ali alayhi salam were so great overcoming these difficulties. The responsibilities of Ali alayhi salam were so great and burdensome that the Khalifa and the religion of Islam depend on them. By solving these problems and overcoming these difficulties, Imam Ali alayhi salam performed a task which made his qualities known to the world. The world came to know how mindful he was of the public's right, how determined he was to promote individual and collective virtues, and with what patience and perseverance he achieved his own objectives. It was a difficult time for Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi. Difficulties that were never faced by anyone before him, difficulties that were never faced by anyone after him. He is in the middle of a revolution that's about to take place, and Amir al-Mu'mineen has to make a choice, and obviously the right choice. He had to establish justice, and for what he did 100 years after, he was cursed publicly on pulpits because he stood against the Umayyad dynasty. He stood against the oppressors. And after that, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, his justice echoed through history, whether they curse him or not. The justice of Ali echoes through history, and the world knew Ali for what he is, for what he really is, the greatest man that walked the face of this earth. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله 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 صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.